Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this podcast is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education.
Hi folks, welcome to the Clinical Problem Solvers. My name is Robbie Jiha, a clinician educator at UCSF. We also have Arslan here. Arslan, what's good with you?
Robbie, I'm feeling really good, man. It's been a while since we recorded. Just the other day, I was talking to my intern working in the CCU, and I asked her how she was doing. She said, you know, I'm really tired. Came to give her some words of encouragement about February and intern year being hard this time of year. She said, oh, yeah, a little bit of that, but I ran 20 miles yesterday. I was like, oh, my God. I really got to reevaluate my life. So, Charmaine, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm good, Arsalan. I'm just coming off a vacation, which was really, really fun and relaxing, and I did not run 20 miles. So I feel pretty bad about myself now. How are you doing, Reza?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking, Charmaine. I'm really excited for tonight's topic, which is eosinophilia.
All right, let's kick it off. So, a 70-year-old man with a history of asthma presents with 6 weeks of fatigue, reduced exercise tolerance, and low-grade fevers. At baseline, he plays tennis and ping pong, but now gets fatigued when he walks more than a few blocks. He denies any chest pain, lightheadedness, shortness of breath, myalgias, abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, or headaches. In the last 3 months, he has had 3 asthma exacerbations, all requiring oral steroids. So for his medical history, he was diagnosed with asthma at the age of 60. He also has hypertension, GERD, and nasal polyps. He takes omeprazole, albuterol, aspirin, budesonide, and atorvastatin. He has never smoked and drinks alcohol socially. He has never used any marijuana, cocaine, or amphetamines. He lives in California and has never traveled outside the region.
So this is a 70-year-old man with history of nasal polyps and adult onset asthma with multiple recent exacerbations, presenting with subacute decrease in exercise tolerance and low-grade fevers.
So in keeping with the recurrent theme of this podcast, I want to distinguish the foreground of this case from the background. The foreground being what is the main presenting features for this patient, while the background is the relevant past medical history or exposure that can help us frame the foreground. Here, I would say the foreground is exercise intolerance and low-grade fevers. Exercise intolerance is very nonspecific and difficult to build a differential around. But I would ask clarifying questions to gauge whether this intolerance stems from shortness of breath, weakness, gait instability, or simply fatigue. Fevers reflect an inflammatory process, which would prioritize infections, autoimmune processes, or malignancies. And the subacute nature here makes pyogenic bacterial infections less likely.
Let's clarify the background a little bit more and review the illness script for asthma. And just as a reminder, illness script is how I think of it as a mental representation of a disease and has the who, what, when, and why. So it includes the epidemiology and risk factors, clinical syndrome, time course, and the pathophysiology of the disease. So for asthma, it's a common chronic condition that is characterized by 4 features: variable and recurrent symptoms, airflow obstruction, underlying airway inflammation, and bronchial hypersensitivity. It is the interaction between these features that determines the patient's presentation and the severity of the disease. Usually diagnosed in childhood or young adulthood, the episodic symptoms include wheezing, shortness of breath, chest tightness, or cough. Triggers often include smoking, allergens, or infections.
Hey folks, make sure to check episode 71 from our friends the Curbsiders for a terrific all-round discussion of asthma. Let's now talk about diagnosing this episodic disorder. Before we do that, we're going to take a step back and talk about episodic disorders in general. Diagnosing these conditions is really tough. And think about examples that range from common syndromes like migraines and biliary colic to rare and esoteric things like pheochromocytoma. Most patients with these syndromes don't present with active symptoms, and thus the diagnosis is plagued by the inherent decay in the precision of the history and the generally lower sensitivity of additional testing when your patient sitting in front of you is completely asymptomatic. The same is true of asthma. Most patients have completely normal PFTs when they're feeling good. This, of course, is helpful in ruling out other causes of respiratory complaints, but renders asthma as a working diagnosis, not a confirmed one.
So anytime I see a patient with a past medical history of COPD or asthma who presents to the hospital with shortness of breath, cough, dyspnea, or wheeze, I reflexively ask, what did their PFTs show? It is helpful if they have PFTs while they're symptomatic that confirms the diagnosis. And I'll highlight this point through a haiku. A haiku consists of three lines. The first line is five syllables. The second line is seven. And the third line is five syllables. The reason I'm telling you this is because I had a YouTube what a haiku is. And I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But bear with me. All wheeze, not asthma. All wheezes are obstruction. Centaur's tweets are beautiful. We learned from Gurpreet Dhaliwal and Kelly Arps in episode 9 that 1/3 of cellulitis diagnosed in the hospital is incorrectly diagnosed. In a recent multi-centered JAMA publication in 2017, 1/3 of patients with physician-diagnosed asthma had their asthma diagnosis ruled out on reevaluation. So in that study, the patients most likely to have a diagnosis of asthma excluded included patients who weren't using their daily asthma medications and patients who didn't have a PFT at the time of diagnosis. So what are mimics of asthma? What do we mistake for the diagnosis of asthma? The most common includes upper airway cough syndrome, which includes allergic and non-allergic rhinitis or sinusitis, and GERD. Other diagnoses include chronic cough due to an ACE inhibitor, a post-viral cough, bronchiectasis, interstitial lung disease, ischemic heart disease, and paradoxical vocal cord motion. We'll have the complete list on the show notes for you.
All right, let's get his exam. So he was afebrile, had a heart rate of 80, a blood pressure of 150 over 70, breathing 98% on room air, and breathing comfortably at 14 breaths per minute. He was comfortable and in no acute distress. His lung exam was notable for diffuse expiratory wheezes. His belly was soft and non-tender. His neurologic exam was normal, and his skin was without any rash or edema. His CBC came back with a white blood cell count of 20,000, 15,000 of which were neutrophils, and 1,200 of which were eosinophils. His hemoglobin was 11 with a normal MCV, and his platelets were 300.
All right, let's update our problem representation here. So we have a 70-year-old man with a past medical history of nasal polyps, adult onset asthma with multiple recent exacerbation, who presents with subacute decrease in exercise tolerance, low-grade fevers, who was found to have diffuse wheezing, leukocytosis, and eosinophilia.
Alrighty, let's talk about eosinophilia. So we define it by absolute eosinophil count, which is just the number of eosinophils in peripheral blood. And when it's greater than 500 eos per microliter, that's considered abnormal. There are three buckets that we usually think of for elevated eos: mild, which is 500 to 1500, moderate 1500 to 5000, and severe, which is greater than 5000 eos in a microliter of blood. Although breaking down the degree of eosinophilia can be helpful to narrow the differential diagnosis, it's not enough to establish the diagnosis. At the end of the day, all it tells you is that your patient has elevated eos, but not why. It's important to remember that the degree of the peripheral blood eos does not always accurately predict the risk of organ damage, because eos are primarily tissue-dwelling cells. Although complications are more common with higher levels, like greater than 1500, some patients with mild eos can have organ involvement. The three organs that are most often involved include skin, lung, and GI tract. It might be a complete coincidence, but I like to remember them as the organs that are most exposed to the outside world. Heart and nervous system can also be involved, and that can be more concerning and life-threatening. But as we mentioned, any tissue can be infiltrated by the EOs, as there are tissue dwellers after all.
All right, folks, it's that time in the case. You know this. It's time when you get to lie in the river full of red blood cells. Except there's one change. This time, that river's full of EOs. Learners, what is your approach to eosinophilia?
Okay, so the approach to eosinophilia is similar to the approach to any cell line abnormality which is increased. You're asking the question, is this primary due to a clonal expansion, or is it secondary due to a stimulus? So the primary causes include eosinophilic leukemia, which comes in two flavors, acute and chronic, and primary hypereosinophilic syndrome. The reactive causes, I think of in five categories, but think of the top three categories we often consider on our show. This includes cancers, infections, autoimmune diseases. And the autoimmune reminds me that the other two categories start with A, which includes allergic disorders and adrenal insufficiency. I'll name a few common examples in each category, but we'll have a much more extensive list on our schema, which will be located on the website. So for malignancy that result in eosinophilia, this includes hematologic cancers like CML and systemic mastocytosis, or any B or T cell lymphoma. Solid tumors include adenocarcinoma of the gastrointestinal tract. The one infection to consider are parasitic helminths that may be endemic worldwide. For example, strongyloidiasis. And this is an important one because if you treat someone with eosinophilia with steroids and they have strongyloidiasis, this can result in disseminated hyperinfection. And that's why we send this serology while we're evaluating someone with eosinophilia. The other infection I want to highlight are fungi, including disseminated coccidiomycosis, histoplasmosis, and cryptococcosis. The autoimmune disease worth noting is eosinophilic granulomatosis polyangiitis. As far as allergic disorders, they can be organ-specific like atopic dermatitis or a drug reaction like DRESS. And the one I include at the bottom, the fifth category, is adrenal insufficiency, which results in a mild eosinophilia and usually in a sick patient. Remember, the eosinophils are extremely sensitive to steroids. So in someone who's adrenally insufficient and doesn't have endogenous corticosteroids, they may have a mild eosinophilia. And this might be your clue to a patient who's hypotensive with eosinophilia in the ICU. So just to summarize, five categories, the three main ones, cancers, infection, autoimmune, and the autoimmune reminds you to say allergic disorders and adrenal insufficiency.
All right, let's get some more data. So his creatinine returned at 1.2 and his baseline is 0.7. His LFTs were normal. His ESR was elevated at 62. His urinalysis showed 4 white blood cells, 1 plus protein, 1 plus blood, and 13 red blood cells. These red blood cells were non-dysmorphic, but there were several RBC casts. His urine protein to creatinine ratio was 1.2. And AM cortisol returned at 24. Estrangeloides antibody was negative, and a stool ONP was negative. On review of his imaging the last few months, he has had several x-rays and CTs showing multifocal waxing and waning peripheral infiltrates.
So to summarize, this is a 70-year-old gentleman with adult onset asthma presenting with subacute decreased exercise tolerance and low-grade fevers, found to have elevated inflammatory markers, moderate eosinophilia, migratory peripheral pulmonary infiltrates, and AKI with hematuria and proteinuria.
AKI. I can't wait to have a full episode on AKI. But here's the summary. You know that I love to localize a lesion, and a large fraction of kidney injury does not localize to the kidney itself, but rather to the plumbing of this incredible organ. And there are really two plumbing systems. The first, the vascular system, responsible for getting blood to and from the kidney. The problems here are too little volume, like hypovolemia, to much volume like congestive heart failure, and some cool things like shunting as occurs in hepatorenal syndrome. The other plumbing is, of course, the collecting system that drains the urine, and the main problem here is obstruction. Most causes of plumbing issues will leave you with a relatively normal UA. This, of course, is an oversimplification of the AKI schema, which I can't wait to talk about. But back to our patient. The abnormal UA makes a problem with the plumbing less likely. Specifically here, the hematuria, proteinuria, and RBC cast are suggestive of glomerulonephritis.
Hey, Robbie, before we continue, let's update that problem representation. So here we have a 70-year-old man with a history of nasal polyps, adult-onset asthma, who presented with subacute decrease in exercise tolerance and low-grade fevers, and was found to have moderate eosinophilia, migratory peripheral pulmonary infiltrates, and glomerulonephritis.
So at this juncture of the case, I would have two Venn diagrams, one for eosinophilia and one for glomerulonephritis, and then I would try to identify what diagnosis links these two problems together. Remember, we've talked about the return of investment for your mental effort, and these two will reveal a diagnosis. Just to talk a little bit about glomerulonephritis, we will for sure have an episode where we'll dive into Robbie's river of GN and discuss it very elaborately. But just very briefly, the clue to glomerulonephritis is nephritic range proteinuria, hematuria, and the clinical manifestation might include AKI, hypertension, and edema. I like to categorize it based on three mechanisms of disease, which includes immunocomplex mediated like lupus, anti-GBM, or ANCA associated. So we'll talk more about the ANCA-associated category as this case unfolds.
The labs return with a negative ANA, a C3 and a C4 that are normal, and an ANCA that is positive for MPO in a perinuclear pattern. These findings prompt a renal biopsy, which showed crescentic, necrotizing, and posse-immune glomerulonephritis.
Hey, I'm John Stockton with the assist here. Charmaine, let's tackle ANCA-associated vasculitis.
Only for you, RC. Let's take a step back. A small vessel vasculitis is usually divided into two categories, immune complex mediated and posse-immune. The most common cause of posse-immune is ANCA-associated vasculitis. So what's ANCA-associated vasculitis? It's a necrotizing vasculitis affecting most often the small blood vessels like the arterioles, capillaries, and the venules that can lead to multi-organ disease. Lung, kidney, and skin are the organs that are most commonly affected. Patients often have systemic signs of inflammation like fever and evidence of end-organ damage ischemia. Palpable purpura and glomerulonephritis is common. Remember that some drugs, like hydralazine, can cause drug-induced ANCA-associated vasculitis, but this is pretty rare. So the three ANCA-associated vasculitis that we want you guys to think about, and these are rare diagnoses, are GPA, MPA, and EGPA. So a granulomatous with polyangiitis, GPA, is best known for granulomatous inflammation of upper and lower respiratory tracts, like the destructive sinusitis that it can happen with this disease. It's associated with C. ANCA, and cavitary lung lesions is pretty unique to GPA. Microscopic polyangiitis, MPA, is associated with P. ANCA. Bronchiectasis and ILD is unique to MPA, and diffuse alveolar hemorrhage that can be life-threatening is more common in MPA. However, MPA and GPA share many clinical features. Often what distinguishes MPA from GPA is lack of granulomatous inflammation on path. Okay, RC, I'm getting tired of my own voice. Do you want to tackle the GPA?
Sure, but I'm never tired of your voice, Charmaine. So eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, or EGPA, shares a lot of the symptoms of the other ANCA-associated vasculitis that Charmaine went over, such as B symptoms, but less commonly involves the kidney. The distinctive features of EGPA include adult-onset asthma, allergic rhinosinusitis, eosinophilia, and a higher frequency of vasculitis involving the GI tract, nerves, and heart. And the ANCA is positive in about 30 to 60% of patients, but it's not needed for the diagnosis.
So, owing to the constellation of refractory asthma, eosinophilia, a positive NPO, and glomerulonephritis, he was diagnosed with eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. He was treated with cyclophosphamide and prednisone and was discharged with plans for close follow-up.
All right, so let's look back at her clinical journey. We had a patient who presented with exercise intolerance and low-grade fevers. His background was significant for nasal polyps and adult-onset asthma. And on further workup, we discovered moderate eosinophilia, transient peripheral lung infiltrates, and glomerulonephritis, which landed us on the diagnosis of EGPA. And I just want to make the point that when you have eosinophilia, make sure to look at the absolute eosinophilic count and try to categorize it as mild, moderate, and severe and build a differential based on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Categorizing the amount might be helpful, but just remember to always look for evidence of end organ damage because it often doesn't correlate to the level of eosinophilia. Remember, they're tissue-dwelling cells. Alrighty, folks. Make sure to check out our schemas on our website, clinicalproblemsolving.com. There you can subscribe to our weekly email summarizing the schemas and other awesome pearls. Email us at theclinicalproblemsolvers@gmail.com and check us out on Twitter at CPSolvers and our YouTube channel, The Clinical Problem Solvers. We can't wait to hear from you guys. And I can't wait for this week's teaser.
Ooh, you know, this week's teaser is really tricky. And I think that as we talked about, eosinophilia is incredibly daunting and there are so many causes. And unfortunately, with this teaser, we're going to have you dive down to the absolute bottom of that eosinophilic river. And the question for today is, can you name not one, but two causes of eosinophilia and angioedema? Why angioedema? I have no idea. But two causes of eosinophilia and angioedema. Hint, one of them may be a perfect description of the show.
That's a wrap, folks.